Vox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 411 on the podcast today. Dave Wall, MD, Managing Director of 88 Energy. Ticker code 88E. I don't know if you've heard of them. A lot of people have, and it's been the star stock pretty much of January, February. It's almost 10 bagged from the low to the high. Plus, also, financial author and investor Rodney Hobson talks about his new book, The Book of Scams, and he also chats about the markets and his strategy in this type of environment.
The Vox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Managing Director of 88 Energy. That's 88E, the ticker. It's Dave Wall. Thanks for joining me again, Dave.
Thanks, Justin. It's good to be back.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I've said previously, you know, we chatted back in January, early January, and the share price then was down at 0.35 pence. Right now, it's at 2.1 pence. That's six times. And I think from low to high, it's pretty much 10 bags. So I assume in between us chatting, there's been some good news.
Yeah, that's right, Justin. And as you know, we've got a very large project up on the north slope of Alaska, over 272,000 acres. And we drilled a well on that project late last year called Icewine Number 1. And it's the Project Icewine is the name of the project. And, you know, ostensibly we're chasing a new resource play type in a shale called the HRZ. So after drilling that well, we sent the core that we acquired during the drilling off to the lab. And all the results that have been coming back from the analysis on that core have been confirmatory of the pre-drill predictions made by our joint venture partner, Burgundy Exploration, which is headed up by Paul Brzezinski, who's somewhat of a shale expert. And, you know, the market's starting to respond to the positive news as we de-risk the play further and further. And I guess, you know, because the size of the prize is so big, people are able to see through this sort of low oil price environment that we're in to the potential value down the track.
Okay, well, let's go through some questions. First and foremost, I chatted to, on Friday, Steve Staley, and he said, yeah, this is pretty much what we were looking for at 88 Energy. Is that the same? Because there's a question here. Has the quality of the samples matched or exceeded expectations?
Yeah, so that's right. It has matched or exceeded. So there is nothing at this stage which has come in below expectations. Everything that we see is, you know, as per what the predictions were. So things like permeability has exceeded expectations. Porosity we knew would be high and is high. You know, rock mechanics, whilst it's still a little bit early on that front, we're seeing similarities between the Marcellus and the Haynesville, which are very successful North American shale plays in their own right. And then, of course, the most recent news was related to thermal maturity. And this is really one of the key pieces of information. And we had kind of given guidance that the thermal maturity was looking good, but the final data on that came in just in the last couple of days, and we released that to the market. And obviously that's had a big impact, because that is key to defining the sweet spot of where the play will be or maybe most productive, because you have the intersection of volatile oil with gas condensate window where the vapor, the hydrocarbons exist as a vapor in the reservoir, which means it flows like a gas, which is at higher rates and more easily than a fluid. And when it gets to the surface, it's liquids, which are obviously more valuable.
Okay, there's a question here. I remember you mentioned a while back, previously stated, there's a 25% chance of commercial success. Have the odds changed now?
Yeah, certainly the odds have definitely changed. I would say it's at least double that. I mean, it's I guess some of the question marks around that commercial success revolve around the oil price and also what the costs are going to be to develop the project. And, you know, the cost and the oil price are quite interdependent. And so that's our next challenge, you know, is planning the horizontal well, which we're doing, and then trying to figure out what the cost will be in different price environments and what the economics will be.
Okay. Have you been speaking to potential JV partners, or has anyone approached you? Have you had more conversations since this positive find?
I mean, we had a crack at farming the project out last year and had started a few conversations which have been continuing. I can say that. However, you know, I wouldn't say that we're close to doing a deal.
Okay. Next question is, what will be the next couple of news events and by when?
Yeah, okay. So there's a bunch of news coming up. So we will have some more data on rock mechanics. So, you know, in sort of more technical terms, we know what the Brinel hardness of the rock is, but we haven't done the test to determine Young's modulus and Poisson's ratio. And in, you know, layman's terms, this is really how brittle or ductile the rock is and how easily fracture simulated it is. And then if you do fracture simulate it, will the cracks stay open or will they just close up? So that's what those tests are designed to do. So we will be getting results from that over the course of the next few weeks. And then we have also started integrating the data from the core back into the log analysis. So while we drill, you know, we run logs, and then, you know, once you get definitive data from the core, you can go back and calibrate the logs, which corrects them effectively to, you know, for the actuals from the core. And once you've done that, you can then start to measure water and oil saturations, which then gives you an idea of, you know, and then you can calibrate the porosity, which gives you an idea of net to gross pay, and then how much oil is in place, and then that drives, you know, your resource estimation. So that is a piece of work that's now in progress. You know,
Go on, Dave.
I was just going to say, you know, I'll finish up. You know, and there is a bunch of other stuff, but they're kind of two key things, and then obviously we're going to start shooting seismic next month.
Okay, cool. So the first bit of news is what, do you think? What will it be?
Well, the petrophysical evaluation, which helps us with our internal numbers, and the rock mechanics, were both happening concurrently. So they should happen within... We should have an update on both of those within the next sort of 2 to 3 weeks.
Marvellous. All right, next question is, what results are potentially needed before this can be confirmed as the next big Alaskan discovery?
Well, really what you need is the, you know, the black stuff flowing out of the ground. And until that happens at a decent rate, you know, this isn't going to be, you know, the next big thing. It will be possibly the next big thing, and we'll be able to de-risk it to a point such that the option value of the project increases, which is what is happening now. However, until we actually get a flow rate, you know, we can't really call it the next big thing. And that well, Icewine 2H, you know, we're targeting to have all the permitting and everything in place so that that could spud by the end of the year. But you could probably guess that things will slip as they always do. And, you know, probably Q1 is probably a more realistic expectation, 2017.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And next question. Do you need to embark on more fundraising in the near term or near medium term?
Near medium term, not near term. So we obviously raised a bit of money towards the end of last year. Pardon me. And that will fund, you know, the final contribution towards the drilling, which has come in on budget, and we'll release the details of exactly what those numbers are over the coming weeks as well, because they're just in the process of being finalized. And then, you know, we have our seismic program, and then we have the acreage purchase. So if you think about the context of us having, you know, $6 million or so post the drilling, that'll pay for the seismic, but then there's, you know, around $5 million worth of acreage payments to make around the middle of the year. And so, you know, the seismic's going to be more than $1 million. So there is a funding gap. It's only pretty small, in the range of, you know, $2.5 to $4 million. And we do have some time up our sleeves in terms of when we fund that. You know, ideal world scenario, we'd get a partner to come in at, you know, highly accretive terms. But as I said, we're not close to doing a deal. So timing-wise, closing a deal within that time frame before, say, May, June, which could be the first payment, pretty tough, I'd say. So there is a chance we'll be coming back to the market in a few months.
Okay. Next question is, can you confirm or deny what many bulletin boards are saying, that you once said in a statement that 8AT could be a 100 or 200 bagger?
No, I mean, certainly it could. I mean, if you think about, you know, and there's a number of analogs out there, but they're all in much higher oil price environments. But, you know, one of the market darlings in Australia, and you know, these guys did it pretty much picture perfect by the book. A company called Aurora, they had 30,000 acres in the Eagleford. They sold half to Hillcorp and had 15,000, and then they increased that to 22,000 and drilled a whole lot of wells and raised money and debt over the next 4 years, and they went from 10 cents to $4.40, and that was on a starting base of 30,000 acres. It was in Texas, higher oil price environment, and lots of infrastructure, so it's not really an apples-for-apples comparison. But we have 272,000 acres, 212,000 acres net to us. So on that basis, you know, the scale that we have, you know, probably offsets some of the you know, the cons that we have, that, you know, we don't have all of the infrastructure like they have in Texas, and, you know, the oil price isn't great. But certainly, if this thing does work, and it works in a big way, the leverage for investors remains enormous because of the size of our acreage position.
Yeah. Wow. That's, I think that's why, you know, so many people are into the story of 88 Energy, because the potential, you know, is there. If everything goes well, it goes right. Like I said, there is that huge potential. Okay. When will the independent revised report be ready?
That'll probably take 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay. All right, cool. Next question is, what is your understanding and opinion as to why the ASX does not seem to believe in 88 Energy quite as much as the LSE?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think what I would say is that, and people will understand this quite well on the LSE or AIM, is that, especially in the initial placements done by the company up until this most recent one, we haven't been able to access our demographic in UK to be able to place stock in UK. So what that does is you get a natural overhang in Australia from people that have got stock at a discount to the, you know, the recently traded share price, so they're advantaged somewhat. Whereas we, you know, we've tried in the UK, but, you know, we just haven't managed to crack that nut. And so there's less of an overhang. So, you know, when there is good news, people are taking profits earlier in Australia than they might be in the UK. And also, okay. I think what you find is Australia is not as influenced by market makers, so you get these, you know, potentially some false momentum at times, which causes the stock to overshoot sometimes a little bit.
Okay, all right. Next question regarding the RNS dated 29th of the 5th, 2015, the Morocco exit finalised, which stipulates that Galp is entitled to a payment of $3.4 million in cash or 88 Energy stock if the market capitalization of 88 Energy reaches or exceeds $50 million before September 2021. What are the terms for this? For example, if the market cap stays above $50 million for so many days, is this triggered, or does the market cap have to be greater than $50 million for a while? What's the deal there?
No, the trigger is just for the market cap to meet or exceed $50 million.
All right, so that payment is due, is it?
There is a contingent liability that will turn into a liability that has to be paid, you know, within a certain time frame.
Okay, all right. So, well, that's the questions, Dave. We had loads of duplicates, but, you know, we've covered most of them. So what's the feeling there? I mean, you must be pretty happy now. I mean, do you feel like it couldn't be going any better, or is this, you know, or do you think, oh, maybe it could have been better, what?
No, I mean, I think at this point in time, and I've said it, in, you know, in my little MD comment in a number of the announcements, and it's getting a little bit old probably, is that at this stage, you know, we could not have hoped for it to be going any better than it is. You know, obviously, if the oil price was higher and, you know, other things like that in the external environment that are beyond our control, you know, that'd be better. But in terms of what we can control to some extent, which is, you know, Paul Buzynski's put together this model, which has, you know, been very accurate so far. You know, it's all lining up.
Yeah, and I suppose that the oil price being low helped you to start to attain these assets, you know, at a reasonable rate. And like the oil price will not stay low. We have seen the cyclicality of oil prices, and it can't stay low like this for a long time, can it?
No, that's right. I mean, you know, this time's different. You know, that's what everyone says every time. But rarely is it different. And I don't think this time will be any different. And, you know, like every other commodity, it goes in a cycle. Shape of that cycle, you know, does change sometimes. So this shape might be a little different than the last shape. But, you know, the trend upwards is inevitable.
Yeah. And do you pay any attention? I mean, do you join in with these? I mean, I've heard several people now saying, you know, well-placed people saying they see the oil price staying low for the first half this year, but gradually maybe breaking out above that $35 range towards the second half. Do you put any stock in that, or do you don't bother with it, with trying to predict the oil price?
The only thing I usually say is that if enough people are long on that trade, they're in for a bit of pain. There'll be a pain trade in there, which will mean it'll jump earlier, or later. So usually the consensus on these things is wrong.
Cool. Dave, listen, it's nice to chat to you again. Thank you for coming on, taking the time. And listen, you know, I know you'll be releasing news soonish because you've got a lot going on there. So please come back on and chat.
Will do. Thanks, Justin. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is investor and author of such books as Small Companies, Big Profits, Understanding Company News, How to Build a Share Portfolio, The Dividend Investor, Shares Made Simple, and current book, The Book of Scams. Rodney, thanks for coming back on.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Justin.
Now, let's talk about the Book of Scams. Let's cover it slowly here, and we'll go back to it at the end. First of all, what's it about? Obviously, it describes what it's about, but why have you gone into this? Why scams?
Scams have been a bit off my normal beat, I must admit. I normally use it investing, but scams have been so much in the news over the past few months that scarcely a week goes by without some scam being mentioned in the papers, and people keep falling for them. And I felt there had to be scope for a book which laid out to the ordinary investor and the ordinary punter just how people are taken in, how scams operate, the sort of things you have to look for, and the sort of things you can do to avoid being taken in by these silver tongued people who ring you up or send you emails or even call at your front door.
Okay, and are these scams just based in the investment world or all kinds of scams?
All kinds of financial scams. They range from people who are trying to get access to your bank account, trying to persuade you to give details of your banking arrangements, trying to get hold of your credit card or credit card details, and even just knocking the front door and saying, do you want tarmac laid on your drive, or you know, your roof needs repairing, this sort of thing. There's a whole range of scams out there, and they do fall into patterns, so you can start seeing them.
I was going to say that. I mean, in this day and age, I suppose, with everything being a lot faster, a lot of stuff done by, you know, electronic versions, like years ago, you know, people had to withdraw money, go to their bank account, or to pay someone, go to their bank account, their local branch. These days, it can happen with a couple of clicks on your computer, and I suppose it's all too easy, and it can happen all too fast, where someone could just you know, say, oh, please pay this, or change your password here, and then all of a sudden your bank account is a couple hundred quid lighter if you're lucky. So I suppose it happens a lot faster these days, doesn't it?
Yes, modern technology has brought a golden age for scammers, because you can do so much so quickly, and you send out emails, you just scatter them around, or you have a computer generating telephone calls, so you just pick one up immediately, you put one down. So you can get hold of a lot of people very rapidly, and you don't need all that many people to fall for the scam in order to make a decent living. You just catch out one person per day if you're working on your own, get a couple of £1,000 off them. It's a very nice little earner. But of course, where you get organized scams and they work in teams, then the proceeds are very, very much greater. And overall, I mean, online banking fraud is the fastest growing crime of any description in the country at the moment. It's reckoned that the amount lifted doubled from about 60 million to 130 million last year. So it's growing rapidly. And yes, people are making a very nice living, and modern technology does make it so much easier.
Yeah, and so you say there are certain traits, certain patterns that these scams fall into. I mean, can you give an example, Rodney?
Yes, you should always be suspicious of anybody who starts asking for details of your bank account, and particularly anybody who asks for a password or a PIN number. This is always a scam, because these are things your bank would never ask for. It is difficult, because sometimes the scammers will ask for, say, security questions, which your bank would genuinely ask for if they were ringing you up. So be very careful of the questions that you're asked, and be careful you don't give away information that will help the scammer. But that's one of the main patterns, is they try to get more and more detail off you, because the more detail they've got, the more chance they have of getting money out of your account.
Yeah, and is it fair to say, I'm going by experience, my mother, for example, late 60s now, You know, she can take or leave the internet. Doesn't bother her. She doesn't. If she has to use it, she will use it. But I've seen, every now and again, I help her with the email, and I've seen sort of scam emails from, you know, purportedly HSBC. And I know it's a scam because she doesn't even bank with HSBC. And to her, it'll say, oh, change your password here. And I'm thinking, if that was someone of a mother's age who's the same sort of experience on the internet, who actually owned an HSBC account, they may fall into that, you know?
Yes, indeed. This is one of the things in way how you do spot some of the scams. Yes, they scatter them round people because there is bound to be a certain percentage of those who receive the email who do actually bank with HSBC, as you say, and they just keep taking one bank at a time and going round. And sometimes, even if you don't have an account with that particular bank, you may panic and think, what on earth is going on? I'd better contact them and tell them I don't have the account. Once you start clicking on any link or attachment in an email, that's when you're in trouble, because they will download malware onto your computer and they'll find out where you really do bank and if you've done any online banking, because they've got the details.
Yeah, do you know, it's amazing. I think my mother's with Outlook, I think, email provider. It's that even as sophisticated as like Gmail or Hotmail, whatever Outlook are, these scam emails still manage to get through every now and again. That's quite scary, isn't it, really?
Yes, yes, they do. I mean, the good guys are forever running faster and faster to try to counteract it. But every time somebody comes up with a new scam or a new way of doing it or some new software, then Google and Amazon all the, and Microsoft and so forth are forever having to counteract it. So there will always be things getting under the radar from time to time. I'm afraid that you won't ever avoid that altogether.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm talking about the process of writing, because I've written the odd thing, blog posts. I've tried to write a book before. But I was looking at your books there, the Book of Scams, Shares Made Simple, The Dividend Investor, How to Build a Share Portfolio, Understanding Company News, Small Companies, Big Profits, Inspector Paul Amos, Detective Stories. When you start to sit down and write a book, Rodney, how long does it take you from the idea to actually completing the book? How do you get it done? You're such a prolific writer.
Yes, the amount of time taken does vary enormously. For example, Shares Made Simple was something that had been brewing in my mind for about 10 years or more. And as soon as Harriman House, the publisher, showed some interest, it all poured out. And I wrote that with amazing speed, probably over about 3 months. But it does take discipline. You do have to sit down and do it. But so much of the knowledge, particularly on the financial side, so much of the knowledge is there, and you come across it doing your normal job. So, in fact, knocking it into a book, somehow it does often flow. And the great thing about writing the book is rather like running the marathon. You reach a point where you think, I might as well finish it now. I've got so far. So you do sort of, the further I get on with it, the faster I write.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about the markets. I mean, at the moment, personally, Roddy, so how many shares is in your portfolio run about?
There's about 16 in my portfolio. At the moment, I'm not all that much ahead. I've been building the portfolio up since 2009, and at the bottom of the market about a week ago, I found that I'd got virtually all my gains had been wiped out. We've built some back in over the past three trading days while we're doing better. But it did occur to me that, in fact, thousands of pounds, I never sort of stopped to tot it up, but thousands of pounds has been added to my portfolio just from the dividends I've got. So even if my portfolio is showing nothing in share price gains, doesn't matter, I'm thousands of pounds ahead, a high percentage ahead, simply from the dividends I've got. And of course, that is the thing that I always stress about stock market investing, is not just the movement of the stock market indices, it's the dividends you get that's so important.
Yeah, it's true. I did a rough calculation on, I think it was from, the dot-com burst up until present. And I think even if the stock market got up and down like it had and it stayed where, pretty much FTSE 100 stayed where it was, if you were getting around about 3%, 3-5% on your dividends, you'd still have made, several hundred quid, which is better than putting it in the bank, you know? So
Yes, absolutely. That's the thing to remember. If I put the money in the bank, yes, I'd still have had the same amount in the bank as I've got now in my shares, except for all the dividends being added on, which is, like, as you say, you're talking about probably an average about 3.5% interest per year, which you can actually do composite, because I keep buying more shares with it. I don't take the cash out, I buy more shares and then gain more dividends. But you just don't get at the bank. What would you get? Less than half of 1% if you're lucky.
What's your outlook on the economy here, Rodney? I mean, do you think we're in looking towards... I mean, a lot of people have been mentioning the big R word, the recession. Do you think we're headed for recession?
I don't think we're heading for a recession, no. I mean, clearly the economy has never taken off as well as we might have hoped since the bottom of the recession somewhere in the middle of 2008. It has grown. It's not grown all that well, but I tell you what, as long as it keeps growing, I'm reasonably happy, because at least it's growing. It's not recession. Even Europe, which we tend to sort of poke fun at, and the Eurozone as a whole has been growing now for the past 5 years. So although bits of it do have recession, there's always other bits of it that are doing reasonably well, and it balances out. And growth isn't great. You're getting something like 0.3 or 0.4% a quarter. So annual growth of something like 1.5%, but it's still growth. The world hasn't come to an end. And I think the stock market has greatly overreacted to all the fears out there.
Yeah, and we've seen inflation figures out today. They are at a 12-month high, but they're still 0.3% they rose. It's a pretty weak figure, isn't it?
It is a weak figure, but I don't worry about the absence of inflation. Listen, I remember the 60s and the 70s when inflation was really taken off and people were horrified and you were scrambling to negotiate pay rises to try to keep up with the rate of inflation. It was horrendous. And now everybody's wringing their hands and saying, no, we don't have inflation and we might have a bit of deflation. I think that modest inflation, very modest inflation, is a very good thing, because particularly at a time when, as you mentioned, bank interest rates are very poor, if you have non-existent or very low inflation, at least it's not eating away the value of your cash. So I think that the modest inflation we've got is a very good thing. I wish that the target of 2% was not a medium target. I wish that was the cap, that we're trying to put a cap on inflation. I see no merit at all in inflation racing away. I've lived through it. I'm against it.
Yeah, okay. So looking at individual stocks at the moment, let's say you hold over 16, do you have a strategy, Rodney? I mean, do you sort of de-risk and sell some if you're doing quite well in one stock, or just hold on to them?
I tend to hold on to it. I'm very much a long-term investor. And I have to say, one of the things you have to consider is if you sell the stock, what are you going to do with the cash? You're going to buy another stock, which presumably you're going to do if you don't actually need the cash to spend it. And it's very difficult to pick stocks at the moment, because companies that have been heavily battered, for example, Anglo American, which brought out pretty horrendous results today, would you go into mining? You might have done at one time, thinking they'd bounce back. There's no signs of coming back. I mean, oil has been badly hit, though. It's better than mining. So it's very difficult to pick sectors that have been badly hit and think, oh, well, let's buy at the bottom. On the other hand, where you've got companies of quality, for example, Reckitt Benckiser has produced very good results this week. Unfortunately, it's already in the share price. And this kind of phenomenon, I've not really known before. Always been things you could look at and say, oh yes, that makes a great buy. I think possibly if I was buying anything now, and let me say, I've used up all my ISA allowance for the year, so I probably shan't invest now until April when we get the new allowance. But if I still had any ISA allowance, I would say to people, buy shares now and try to get in. I would be looking perhaps at utilities, certainly water companies, I think, are the one area that's possibly undervalued. I would certainly want to have a bank in my portfolio, despite all the bank bashing that's gone on and all the worries we have over banking, because I think the bank sector is now undervalued and banks will certainly come back someday. But being cautious in choosing shares now has a greater need than ever before, in my view.
Yeah. So what's the last stock you bought, Ronnie?
The last thing I bought, I think the last top-up I did was with Rio Tinto.
Okay.
Those shares are badly bashed. I thought of the mining companies, it was the one most likely to bounce back. But let me say, it was a very modest investment. Rio Tinto on altogether is now holding its own from my total purchases, so I haven't actually lost money on it, and I have had dividends. But as I say, it was a fairly modest sort of purchase.
Okay, and I mean, technically we are in what's called a bear market. And do you adjust your strategy at all in a bear market or not?
Well, in a bear market, no, I tend to look for shares that I think have been dragged down by the general bear market. Let me say, I know some people reckon if you fall 20%, then it falls 20%, that comes to the bear market. I tend not to draw hard and fast lines on these things. I think you know whether you've been in a bear market or not when it ends and you see how far things have gone. But yes, in these sort of times, I don't stop investing. I start looking for the good quality shares that have been dragged down in the bear market, and I'm prepared to buy even if we haven't reached the bottom, in the hope and expectation that the shares will start to move higher in due course, and over the long term I will still gain. And I think that when we have a bear market, it is very important to look for companies that are paying dividends, so you've got that consolation, and paying dividends that are well covered. So covered at least 1.5 times, preferably covered twice over.
Yeah, just interesting. So do you sort of always have a bit of cash in your account ready to invest?
I don't always know. I tend to remain fully invested. I say I run an ISA account and I put the money in at the start of the year, and over the course of the year I tend to invest it, and I tend to reinvest the dividends. When the dividends are built up to say £1,000, I tend to reinvest that, because online stock broking, you know, I'm only paying £10 for a trade, so I'm happy to keep topping shares or even go to new ones with just £1,000 and building up. I'm very much your ordinary punter.
Marvellous. Ronnie, lovely to speak to you, and your book, The Book of Scams, is out now. I'll put a link to that on the web page here. But it should be an interesting read. Do you know what? You've got a library of books there I'd like to get through. So, Rodney, thanks for coming on. Speak soon, fella.
Okay, cheers.
That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, please take part in the Vox Markets Oil Price Sweepstake. Go to voxmarkets.co.uk/OPS. And if you guess precisely what the price of Brent crude will be at midday on Friday, then you'll win a quadruple rollover. So it stands at the moment, you'll win $132 plus next week's price of, or sort of Friday's price of Brent crude, which will be around about $30 at the moment. I've got a guess of $35.35 in, I think. They range at the moment, the guesses, from $37.34 all the way down to $28.57. What do you reckon? If you're spot on, you win cash. So go to voxmarkets.co.uk/OPS. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.